This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past 3 months, we've learned more about the murky back channels of nuclear proliferation than we did over the past 30 years. Details of what's being described as a nuclear supermarket began to emerge last October when Italian authorities boarded a German merchant vessel called the BBC China to find that it carried the industrial components of a nuclear weapons program. The ship's destination was Libya. Already in negotiations with the United States and Britain on weapons of mass destruction, Libya decided not just to abandon its nuclear ambitions, but to hand over the names of the individuals, the companies, and the countries that provided the designs, the expertise, and the materials to build atomic bombs. Libya's disclosures led to Pakistan, then to Iran and North Korea, and then to a network of scientists, manufacturers, financiers, and smugglers that stretches from Northern Europe to Southeast Asia. Later in the program, we'll bring you an update on today's Supreme Court decisions, including the death penalty and age discrimination. But first, the nuclear supermarket. If you have questions about how this black market operated and why, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll also talk about why it took so long for all of this to come to light and whether this puts nuclear weapons within the reach of terrorist groups. But first, more details on the breadth of nuclear information and the products in the marketplace. Our first guest is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times, who's with us here in Studio 3A. It's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Always good to be here.
Much of this seems to go back to a man named Abdul Qadir A.Q. Khan, the so-called father of Pakistan's bomb. And his involvement, he's a metallurgist, and goes back to his experience at a nuclear facility in Europe. Tell us how this all began.
Well, A.Q. Khan is perhaps a new name to many Americans, but not a new name to anybody who's been following proliferation issues over a number of years. He, in the 1970s, was working in Europe and worked for a subsidiary of Urenco, which is a European consortium that puts together parts for largely for the enrichment of uranium, something that you do frequently for power production, but which can also be used to enrich bomb-grade fuel. He was working there at around the time that India first announced that it had become a nuclear power, and this
exploded a so-called peaceful nuclear device.
Peaceful nuclear device, right. And this created great urgency in Pakistan, India's longtime rival, to be able to build a program as well. And the government reached out to Khan, and he came back with designs that later on the Netherlands said that he had stolen. In fact, they convicted him for this, but it was later overturned on a technicality. And so for a number of years, he was an importer of nuclear technology to build Pakistani weapons. At some point in the late 1980s, he began to use the same network he had put together to bring in material secretly and became an exporter, first to Iran, then to North Korea and Libya, and probably to other countries that we have yet to discover.
And all of this raises questions, first of all, security at this European plant from which he took the blueprints for the gas centrifuges that are critical industrial elements to manufacture the highly enriched uranium that you need to either, at low enrichment levels, use to fuel nuclear reactors, or at high enrichment levels you can use in nuclear bombs. But he took these blueprints, and then security there was not very lax. He also met any number of people from all across the country who later turn up to be involved in this black market operation distributing nuclear weapons and parts and components and plans all around the world.
He met some, and others he began to gather over the years. And I think that what's most important to know about this network is how little we know about it. The Times started its own investigation into this nearly a year ago. We, of course, had tripped across Khan before, particularly in relation to shipments to North Korea. But what we've learned in the past 3 months, as the Libya story has unfolded and as the Libyans have begun to turn over details of how they assembled their own program, which was not yet near a bomb, has led many to discover a number of different elements of this network we didn't know existed before.
Including, and one element of the Libyan question has intrigued me since it came out, I guess, last week or maybe the week before. It turned out they had produced what are being described as minute amounts of plutonium. Where is that?
Well, the amounts that the Libyans have turned out were so small as to not cause, you know, immediate concern. But the IAEA has reported just today that there are unexplained amounts, of course, in Iran and also of uranium. And then in North Korea, where inspectors have not been for a year and 2 months now, there are very significant quantities of certainly of plutonium and probably now of uranium under a second secret program that appears to have been started with Khan's help.
And that program, it's believed, was a program that Pakistan provided North Korea with information about how to make highly enriched uranium in exchange for North Korean information about how to manufacture long-range missiles.
That's our belief. When some members of our reporting staff went off and interviewed President Musharraf of Pakistan a few weeks ago, he said, no, you've got that all wrong. We paid for those missiles $200 million, and these were separate transactions. This is part of what we still don't fully understand, what the quid pro quo was between two countries that were essentially broke at the time.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to a question. Mike is with us from Livonia, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Mike.
Yes, I have been following the story in the media about Mr. Khan and the Pakistani government's reaction to, I guess, our discovery about what he's been doing. But I haven't really noticed anything about our government's reaction to the whole thing that's happening. And I mean, from my perspective, it seems that Mr. Khan is more or less a terrorist. But his country is considers him a hero.
David Sanger, just by note, President Musharraf has both said that Mr. Khan was involved in this proliferation effort and has already pardoned him.
And has also said that he's a national hero. What your caller has quite rightly focused in on is the remarkable ambiguity in the American position about Pakistan. Remember, Pakistan is the country that we need for chasing after Osama bin Laden. Pakistan we need for our work in Afghanistan. And yet, Pakistan's lead nuclear scientist appears to have been at the center of this network. Now, the Pakistani position is that he was operating as a rogue. And the American government's position has been, whatever the Pakistanis say must be right. On the other hand, he was using the Pakistani Air Force as his personal sort of DHL for delivering these parts around the world. Makes you wonder the degree to which the Pakistani government was unaware of his activities.
Further, the Pakistani, the laboratory at which he worked was under the supervision of Pakistan's army. All of the nuclear weapons programs in Pakistan are strictly controlled by the army, and people less credulous than me have said it defies belief that the Pakistani government, or at least the Pakistani army, and of course at that time Mr. Musharraf was the head of the Pakistani army as well, did not know what was going on.
That's right, and to believe the U.S. position on this, you have to be willing to entertain, at one hand, the U.S. argument that he was acting as a rogue and that nobody in the government leadership knew about him, and on the other hand, that we shouldn't worry about Pakistan's nuclear arsenal of completed nuclear weapons, because that's completely under Mr. Musharraf's control, General Musharraf's control.
Mike, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you.
Going on, though, we speak about A.Q. Khan, but there are others involved, a Sri Lankan businessman who's been involved and named, who's been operating manufacturing parts, apparently, in factories in Malaysia. There are German, Swiss, British, all kinds of people involved in this.
There are, and you know, it's a remarkably multinational enterprise, and shows you what you can do in a globalized manufacturing world. The Malaysian factory was making parts for centrifuges, and you may remember that George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, announced in a speech that he gave at Georgetown that the factory had been closed down after these discoveries. One of our correspondents was given a tour of it fully up and running, though no longer making centrifuge parts, about 12 hours after Mr. Tenet spoke.
These parts were then shipped through Dubai in the Persian Gulf, where payments of suitcases stuffed with currency were exchanged?
That's right. Dubai seems to be one of the transfer points. Mr. Khan had a has a house there. He lives rather well for a man who was on a $2,000 a month government salary. He's got a hotel in Timbuktu. He's got a luxurious house at Islamabad that many government leaders have been to. He's got other properties, but it appeared to be largely a cash business.
And as we look around at who and what has been involved, we also have to ask why. If you believe the rogue scientist theory, the answer to that is simple: greed.
That's right. And if you read A.Q. Khan's writings, at various times he has talked about two other things that motivate him. One is that the United States attempts to dominate a secretive world of how to build nuclear weapons, and he wanted to break out of that. And at other moments, he has talked about the need for Islamic nations to have a bomb of their own. Although those who know him tell us that, in fact, he is much more of a nationalist than any kind of Islamic extremist.
Finally, as this skein of information continues to unravel from Libya to Pakistan to Iran, the Iranians are now engaged with the International Atomic Energy Association, the UN organization, the IAEA, in an effort to explain what they're doing, come clean on their program, which they say is strictly for civilian and electrical power production purposes. Again, there's considerable skepticism about that. Today, the IAEA released a report on recent Iranian discoveries in Vienna. I understand you've had a chance to look at it. What does it say?
The most interesting elements of it suggest that after the Iranians said in November that they were turning over to the IAEA everything they knew about their program, there have been continuing discoveries in a number of different areas. They had a more sophisticated Pakistani centrifuge design that they had not previously reported. There are unaccounted for amounts of uranium. There's a second program to build, to try to come to an alternative way to build a nuclear fuel that, again, the IAEA found. And I think perhaps one of the most interesting things is that the Iranians had argued that traces of highly enriched uranium that had been detected in their visits last year, the Iranians said, came because they had imported parts from Mr. Khan and others that were already contaminated when they arrived in Iran. When you read this report carefully, you discover now that a number of those parts that they made domestically were also contaminated. That's the IAEA stopped short of accusing them of lying about this, but certainly raises a number of questions.
Also, there was a recent discovery of a more advanced centrifuge design found on an Iranian Air Force base, the first obvious connection between this program and the military.
That's the P-2, the Pakistani 2 design. Did not surprise anybody that they had it, because Libya had it, and we believe North Korea did. The big question that's hanging out there, though, is that in Libya, the A.Q. Khan network also sold them a full warhead design, crude but full. And that has not been discovered in Iran, and many investigators wonder whether or not the Iranians have it too.
Originally from China, that design.
Originally.
David Sanger, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times, was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be discussing some of the implications of all of this information. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing nuclear weapons information and material that's being exchanged on the black market. We're also talking about what the U.S. knows and what questions we should all be asking. Of course, you're invited to join us. What are your questions about the proliferation of nuclear weapons capability? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is Gary Milholland, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, a think tank in Washington working to slow the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Gary, good to see you again.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And also with us is Leonard Spector, director of the Monterey Institute Center for Nonproliferation Studies, in charge of their Washington office. It's very good for you to come
in.
Let's begin by listening to part of a speech that President Bush delivered earlier this month at Fort McNair's National Defense University here in Washington, where he addressed the issue of the spread of nuclear capability.
In recent years, another path of proliferation has become clear as well. America and other nations are learning more about black market operatives who deal in equipment and expertise related to weapons of mass destruction. These dealers are motivated by greed or fanaticism or both. They find eager customers in outlaw regimes which pay millions for the parts and plans they need to speed up their weapons programs. And with deadly technology and expertise on the market, there's the terrible possibility that terrorist groups could obtain the ultimate weapons they desire most.
President Bush speaking earlier this month. Leonard Spector, is the now evidence of this network of suppliers and smugglers and financiers, does that really raise the question of making this material available to terrorist groups?
Well, I don't think we know yet. If you looked at some of the specific technology, let us say for enriching uranium or for designing a weapon using this particular design that I think is out there now, probably this is not appropriate for terrorists. You would have to get a whole chain of facilities that would allow you to, in effect, get raw uranium, intermediate product, then a big enrichment plant. It would really take quite a bit of doing, and I think this is still probably something that would have to be conducted at a national level. On the other hand, we now know that these plans are available virtually anywhere, possibly. This is not the first time these plans have been found internationally. Iraq had something similar. In addition, you've got a bomb design, which is now presumably available internationally. We've also learned, I'd say the most disturbing part, is that you can set up a shop anywhere in the world and start building these things totally in a totally innocent location where no one would think to look, and support a weapons program in Libya or Syria, whatever the next country may be.
Gary Milholland, yes, you do need large industrial facilities using these kinds of gas centrifuges to enrich uranium to the point at which it's usable as in a nuclear weapon. But we seem to have missed a lot of those facilities in Iran and in Libya.
Yes, we did. I think you put your finger on what for me is one of the most disturbing aspects of these revelations, and that is that this has been going on for a long time, well over a decade. It's been conducted by people whom we knew. That is, A.Q. Khan has been known to Western intelligence for a long time, and so have his pals, that is, other people in this network. They've been known to us for 20 years in some cases. And so we see these folks setting up secret factories around the world, shipping things back and forth, making these deals, and suddenly we discover that they succeeded. That is, they managed to supply Libya, they managed to supply North Korea, and they managed to supply Iran while either we were not picking it up or picking it up and not doing anything about it. So President Bush just made his speech warning us about these networks. But if you really look behind the words, I think what you see is a giant national security disaster in which we really are essentially unprotected. That is, what we've learned is that this sort of thing can succeed. And so I guess I would say that what we need to do is ask ourselves how we should change what we're doing, either in the intelligence world or elsewhere, or in diplomacy, in order to cut these things off before they succeed.
Let's get some listeners on the line. And this is Tess Fia, who's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
It's Tess Fia.
Excuse me for mispronouncing.
It's all right. First, I want to make a remark that, you know, never mind about WMDs in Iraq. Politics will take care of that. And I think the shallow media ran away with it because it makes scandal. What I am asking is, where Mr. Khan was operating was in countries which where the CIA has human intelligence. They have known about this guy for a long time. Where was the CIA when this guy was going all over the world peddling nuclear weapon? How come they didn't stop him? How come they didn't discover it? Why did it take for Gaddafi to tell the United States that he got it from Pakistan? Why didn't the CIA know all about this?
Well, Gary,
and the amount of money the United States spends on the CIA, they should have been able to pick this up a long time ago.
Gary Mulholland just made that point. One thing, Leonard Spector, that the president did say in his speech, and by the way, that's an excellent question. I'm not meaning to dismiss it at all, but Gary just raised it himself. But the intelligence did break into this network, maybe belatedly, but yes, that shipment was intercepted in Italy. It was found aboard that freighter, and the process, the unraveling began.
Well, the unraveling began in this case for this network at this point. What we don't know is how many parallel networks there may be. We certainly don't know where these designs are going next. We don't know where the next businessman may want to set up shop. And I think this is what's so disturbing. It's this incredible fragmentation of, if you will, the nuclear marketplace, at the same time when there's a lot of fragmentation at the governmental level, which we were speaking about earlier, where you don't quite know who's in charge in Pakistan, perhaps in Iran. In Libya, while Gaddafi was negotiating with us, somebody was also trying to get these new secret shipments. So it's not even clear that within Libya there was a unified governmental responsibility for all of this. So I'd say this is a very difficult time, and it occurs when we are having so many questions about our own intelligence capabilities that it really compounds the anxiety we're all feeling.
Mm-hmm. Is there any credible answer to the question that you and our phone caller have raised, Gary?
Well, it seems to me that what we're learning is that we haven't really shifted out of our Cold War mode. We've organized our Defense Department and we've organized our CIA bureaucracy to address the Cold War threats.
What we're
learning here is...
I'll give you a chance in just a second. Let Gary answer.
Learning here is that we just haven't adjusted. We aren't able either to pick this up or to do something about it when it's still possible to cut it off. And so I guess I would say that we need to reorganize our efforts. We need to demand more production. That is, if you imagine the CIA as a subdivision of a big company, and the subdivision was supposed to produce X, and it over the years didn't produce X over and over again, then you'd think about changing the management.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we need to do.
May I say one more thing?
Certainly.
Look, everywhere this guy was operating was places where CIA could have put human intelligence. This was not like Iraq, where they didn't have human intelligence, where they didn't have agents on the ground. I am sure there are hundreds of CIA agents swarming all over Europe and Pakistan. Where were they? If you know, when it's a quack, call it a duck. The CIA outright failed the United States and the people of the world, because a nuclear weapon could very easily be in the hand of all kind of dangerous individuals right now.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go now to KK, who's calling from North Wales, Pennsylvania.
Hi, my name is KK. I'm calling from North Wales, Pennsylvania.
Good.
I have a question for Mr. Mulholland. So you've written past about the role of China in proliferation. I think you argued for U.S. not have nuclear trade with China without ensuring guarantees of non-proliferation?
Yes, that's right.
Now, their role has been now clearly proven, one with Libya, where a Chinese bomb design has been found. Number two, with North Korea. Pakistan could not have transferred anything to North Korea without refueling in China.
Hmm. Well, we know that design that was found in Libya was a Chinese design. We don't know that they got it from China. Could they have gotten it from Pakistan, Gary Mulholland?
But they could have originally
Well, my understanding of this design is it was a design that the Chinese actually tested. So we know it works. We know also that they gave it to the Pakistani military. Then the Pakistanis went out into the world market with the design in order to buy its component parts. And so naturally the middlemen in the world got the design. And it could be very well that Libya, in fact, got the design through one of the middlemen rather than getting it through Pakistani sources originally. We don't know that for sure. But the problem is that this is a little bit like a disease. Once you put a design out there in the hands of somebody, you don't have any way of knowing where it might wind up. And so what the Chinese have done is committed just a gross act of proliferation some years ago, which today is still having effects. And so it's very hard to know what the ultimate consequences will be if you do something really reckless like give another country a nuclear weapon design.
Plus the North Korean thing, if the Pakistanis use C-130 planes, they have to have refueled in China. And somebody in China must have known that the Pakistanis and North Koreans are trading with each other. That's the other shoe that still hasn't dropped. Isn't that correct?
I would think on the range of a Hercules, yeah, you'd have to refuel somewhere. And China is a big country, and it sits between Pakistan and North Korea. So I'm just working out a slide rule, I think you might have to be right. But it's a good point, KK. Thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go to Leonard Spector. We can understand, I guess, in sort of, you know, big power reasons. China was having a dispute with India, so you make trouble for India by giving some help for its rival Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. And then you're having these state-to-state things. If the Pakistani deal with North Korea was, we give you nuclear technology, you give us missile technologies, is state-to-state trades. But after that, it does get murky. You seem to be entering a privatized world where people are trading in what used to be the most closely guarded state secrets anywhere.
Well, that's right, and I think that's what's making this so difficult to deal with. If we have a state that is acting in a way we're not happy with, at least we know how to go about trying to influence its behavior. We can't always do it. I mean, with Pakistan today, we have challenges because we want its support on certain things, and we can't push too hard on other things that we might also want. But when you're dealing with these private enterprises, they're elusive. You don't quite know where they are, who they are. You don't know how they're operating. And you're sort of in a world that's a bit like drug smuggling or international organized crime. You can go after it, but it's not as susceptible to working the problem, let's say, as it would be if you had a government that you could negotiate with and try to work a deal with or whatever it might be. So I think this is a really very, very difficult new challenge. And if you hear certain government officials talk about it, they are making these analogies to a new sort of order of things where you can't use these traditional diplomatic tools. You're in a different environment.
We're speaking with Leonard Spector of the Monterey Institute Center on Nonproliferation Studies. He's the director of their Washington office. And with Gary Mulholland, executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, which is here in Washington, D.C. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Travis, who's with us from Tallahassee.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just kind of angry about this whole thing, how all this proliferation has been going on, and we don't seem to have done anything about it. We're the world's only superpower, and I would think we should come down on these guys like a ton of bricks. My question is how the different approaches taken between the Bush and the Clinton administration, and whether the war in Iraq kind of... do you think that had anything to do with Libya's decision to do this? And what does that say to the critics of the war? Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for the question, Travis. Leonard Spector, we had India and Pakistan both explode nuclear devices during the Clinton administration.
Well, that's true. That was a significant setback. I say that hesitatingly since I served in the Clinton administration. I don't want to take too many
I knew that.
Bullets here. But I think the point is that was a sort of confirmation of what the world already knew. India had tested already in 1974. Everyone knew Pakistan had the bomb. A very unfortunate development that really, I think, did crystallize things in a very a way that we're not at all happy with. But some of these other areas, I think, you have to ask, you know, what was the impact of the Iraq war? And I'm not sure that the answers are obvious. On the one hand, Libya may well have said, gee, Libya might be next. We better see if we can cut a deal with the United States, although the timing doesn't seem quite right. They were already reaching out to the United States prior to this, and even after the war, they seem to be engaged in some of these nefarious dealings. In the case of North Korea, the other lesson may have been taken, which is North Korea might be next, they may have feared, and that may have galvanized them to break out of the deal we worked out in the Clinton administration to freeze their plutonium program so that they could then build additional nuclear weapons and have more of a deterrent against our intervention there. So I think we're going to have to really think hard about what has gone on over these past months, and it's going to take a while, I think, until we really understand how these different events influenced each other.
Mm-hmm. Gary?
Well, I think there's a big difference between North Korea and Libya. You see, North Korea, with a program that actually has succeeded, at least in the estimation of the CIA, in making a few warheads. So in that case, North Korea could look at the situation and say, well, we ought to hang on to our warheads because we might need them. Whereas in the case of Libya, Libya's program was not doing very well, and the interception of its big shipment of parts may have convinced Gaddafi that this was just a wasting asset, and so that his nuclear program would be worth more if he traded it in to the West and to the United States than if he continued to try to develop it and suffer under international sanctions. That leaves Iran, which is sort of in the middle. It's a lot farther along than Libya, but it's not as far along as North Korea, and it still hasn't succeeded in making a warhead. And that's really the big case. I think if Iran decides under pressure to give up its program, then we can say to ourselves that we may be on the path toward victory against proliferation. But if it goes the other way, then it's pretty grim.
Are either of you aware, and in a statement about this, when he was in Libya, I think Mr. El-Baradei, the head of the IAEA, said that, you know, we're finding out more information, and indeed other countries may be involved, which leads to the question, well, may be involved as suppliers, or may be involved as recipients of this nuclear information.
I'm assuming that El-Baradei meant suppliers, but it is interesting to start asking yourself who might be next. Now, the classic group was Iran, Iraq, Libya, North Korea, and Syria has weapons of mass destruction in the form of chemical weapons and a biological weapons program and missiles, so you imagine they might have had some interest along the way, although I don't think they've really proceeded very far, although one never quite knows. But who might be the next tier? There's gossip about Myanmar having some connections to North Korea. Some people have suggested that Ukraine or some of the post-Soviet states feel themselves potentially victimized by Russia, and in a very dangerous part of the world, it might be thinking about something of this kind. That I don't mean to name that particular country specifically, but just states that seem to have no interest in these weapons at one time, finding the world shifting around them and perhaps taking a second look.
When we come back from a short break, we'll wrap up our discussion on nuclear proliferation and talk about some Supreme Court decisions issued today, including the death penalty and age discrimination. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we are discussing nuclear proliferation, though in a few minutes we're going to switch subjects and talk about some decisions coming down from the Supreme Court today. But we're speaking with Gary Mulholland, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, which is here in Washington, D.C., and Leonard Spector, who is the Washington Director of the Monterey Institute Center for Nonproliferation Studies. And one of the questions, let's go back to the phones. Here's a caller, Dario from Palo Alto, California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Dario.
Yes, hi. Thank you for your excellent panel. I have two questions. First of all, it seems that worthy though the effort of proliferation is, I think really we're focusing on the wrong thing. We're fighting a rear guard. I think essentially the genie is out of the bottle, and as in the war on drugs, when demand is so high and money is so abundant within terrorist organizations, it's only a matter of time until we do actually face a smuggled terrorist bomb. So it seems to me the real focus should be on really strengthening our detection and intelligence, especially with regard to smuggled bombs in cities. And my final point, and I'll take my answer off the air, is that the way we treat with Pakistan at the moment is a question of real politic. We have to support Musharraf to the hilt, because if he is deposed or assassinated, we're facing a far worse and more unknown threat. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Dario, thanks very much. Leonard Spector, as former government official, certainly the Pakistan question is something the likes of which you have dealt with.
Well, I don't think we've ever dealt with one quite like this, where you have a critically important national leader who has been the subject of two assassination attempts, apparently which were derived from insider information because they had precise knowledge, the assassins, of where he was going to be at a certain time. Where you have a country which is in political, I won't call it turmoil just now, but where the potential for political turmoil is so great, and where we have such critically important but competing interests in dealing with the government. This is really a very, very tough one, and I completely support the caller's viewpoint that we must stand by Musharraf and try to stabilize the country through him and just work as best we can. But this is going to be a long-term process. It is not a quick fix, as is the other issue he raised, which was the question of how do we protect our ports and our cities and have better detection. That is going to take a long time as well. As you know, we only inspect a very small fraction of all the incoming cargo into this country. There is massive smuggling that we still can't control. So we do have a pretty tough row to hoe here.
Gary Mulholland, let me ask you, the fundamental document on this question in terms of international law is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which the United States is signatory. It was referred to again by President Bush when he made his statements about strengthening that treaty and trying to close up some loopholes on the kinds of countries that can be authorized to enrich uranium. Anyway, that's the fundamental document, yet it has some fundamental weaknesses as well, one of which is, as many people call out, the United States and Russia are obliged to be working towards disarmament, which a lot of people see very little evidence of. And there are also other nations that are not members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty who have not signed that treaty, who are causing problems, one of which, of course, is the United States' a very important ally, Israel.
Yes, that's true. Israel's not a member, neither is Pakistan, neither is India. Although I must say that it is true that the United States and the Soviet and Russia are reducing our nuclear arsenals. That is, the number of warheads deployed is going down. But I think the main problem with the treaty is that it doesn't really protect you against the kind of network we've just discovered. That is, if you look at Malaysia, it's a member of the treaty, but it has no obligation to report the export of centrifuge parts from itself to another country.
No evidence Malaysia as a government knew that manufacturing was going on.
Assuming that Malaysia knows that centrifuge parts are being manufactured within its borders, the treaty, unfortunately, does not require Malaysia to tell anybody about that or to stop the parts from going out. Libya, the recipient for these parts, is also a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we've just learned has been violating it rather consistently over the last several years without being detected. That is, the IAEA really isn't set up to detect deliberate violations, secret violations, secret sites in countries that are members of the treaty. Iraq was also a member, and it violated the treaty. So what we have is a treaty which is okay for the good guys, but for the people who want to join it and then cheat, it really does not have sufficient enforcement mechanisms. And unfortunately, the diplomatic climate in the world is such that it's going to be very hard to get the countries of the world to agree on enforcement mechanisms that really work.
Thanks to you both very much, a subject to which we return again and again. Gary Mulholland of the Wisconsin Project, Leonard Spector of the Monterey Institute, we appreciate you both coming in.